Neil, and we're going to be talking for the next hour about the issue of 9/11. Half a generation has passed since the terrorist attacks of 2001, and it could be hard to remember the times before that. So we use the program to reflect on what 10 years of a war on terrorism has done to us. Have we made ourselves more secure? Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org.
This program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
I am joined by the author of Green is the New Red, Mr. Will Potter, by telephone from Washington. Will, welcome to the program.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, it's a pleasure having you. Ralph Nader put out a call to the public on Counterpunch saying people should use the day before the 10th anniversary of 9/11 to gather in their own towns or cities and to discuss ways to avoid overreactions to threats, because he strongly feels that's what's been going on. You probably would echo that, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. Particularly some of the things that Mr. Nader said in this piece, such as not creating a climate of fear in order to push a political agenda and to increase the power of people that are in control. And I think that's something we've seen on the upswing since September 11th that's really been institutionalized, this use of fear to push political agendas.
Well, the title of your book is Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. And I think we ought to say right at the beginning that the FBI admits that it is targeting animal rights and eco-terrorism. It says it is. And certainly you are kind of a believer in animal rights, aren't you?
I'm sympathetic, absolutely. And in a lot of ways, that's how part of this story began, was that I had a background in environmental activism, and I've been vegan for about 13 years now, and I was out leafleting and was arrested by local police for hanging door knockers, and we were charged with disorderly conduct, and ultimately that charge, of course, was thrown out because it's completely legal to hand out leaflets. But this was just a few months after September 11th. I had two FBI agents come to the door and talk to me about this and threaten to put me on a domestic terrorist list. So that was really my background in different political activism, really goes alongside with my journalism career and shaped how I approached this book.
Well, now, what do you make of this? I mean, you know, you could say, well, you know, this is the FBI. They were maybe a little nervous about you, so they came around and talked to you. I mean, what could be wrong with that?
Well, certainly. I mean, one can make the case that that's what law enforcement should do if they're actually investigating a case. You know, you talk to people, you develop leads. I mean, we've all seen the cop shows and Law and Order and everything else. The problem is when you're knocking on people's doors who are arrested for Class C misdemeanors of leafleting and First Amendment activity and threaten to put them on a terrorist list unless they become an informant. And these are actually tactics we've seen used not just since September 11th, but throughout U.S. history against progressive social movements, this use of instilling fear and making people think that they need to become either an informant or turn on their friends or renounce their beliefs or any number of things in order to protect themselves from harassment.
I don't know, you know, you're fairly young, but do you probably have some memory of the battle in Seattle and all that, the demonstrations?
Absolutely. And
Yeah, against WTO and NAFTA and free trade. And it's funny, you kind of wonder what happened to all those people, at least I do. You would think that they'd be coming back now and saying, see, I told you so, I told you so, but I rarely hear from them. And now I'm wondering if maybe they've had to go underground.
Well, and like you said, and for your listeners who might not know, you know, the Battle of Seattle, the protests against the World Trade Organization and placing, the interests of corporations above those of people in the environment. I mean, those concerns are all still there, and people are active in all.
Well, they're more than there. I mean, it's proven that what they were warning about has happened. You know, our jobs have been exported. It's very simple, really.
Well, and not only that, but this at the time, the discussion of globalization was focused on ideas of trade and opening up markets and things like that. What we've seen, particularly in my work, is that it's taken on a different context with the globalization of actually new terrorism laws and new tactics of going against social movements. A lot of the things we've seen happen in the United States of targeting environmentalists as so-called eco-terrorists have now been done in other countries as well. And I've actually seen coordination and communication between U.S. law enforcement and law enforcement overseas in Austria, the U.K., France, Germany, Spain.
Will Potter. We're talking with Will Potter, the author of Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. And he did some leafleting for animal rights and suddenly found himself visited by the FBI shortly after 9/11. Now, let me ask you this. Obviously, you've become politically active on this issue now. And I am wondering if you know for sure whether they ever did put you on the terrorist list.
Well, and that's actually something I researched as part of the book, trying to figure out what the consequences of that actually were. I mean, at the time, I had a Fulbright application pending, and I didn't get it. But then again, you know, it's a Fulbright. Most people don't get them.
Right. I haven't got mine either. Yeah.
So, you know, I realize that's part of the power of all this. And I laugh about all this now. But at the time, it really did instill that fear in me. And it made me wonder what the ramifications would be by refusing to cooperate. When I fly, for the most part, I don't have any problems. I've actually been on the same flight with activists going to a conference recently, and others were stopped and singled out and questioned by TSA, and I went on just fine. But at the same time, I've seen my work appear in counterterrorism unit documents and FBI reports and lots of other things. So the long and short answer is, you know, there's clearly a surveillance infrastructure that's been set up in this country, but the specific threats that some of those agents made, I don't know the extent of how true they were.
Some time ago, we had actually just a few weeks ago, really, we had Anthony Romero, the head of the ACLU, on this program, and I know you have an acquaintance with Anthony. And one of the things that we were talking about is the erosion of the rights, especially Fourth Amendment rights, of people in schools, like students, that they're they've lost most of these rights. It's as simple as that. And I am wondering now about this detention that seems to happen. It appears that enforcement agencies now feel free to detain people and sweat them for a while without notifying anybody. And that seems to me, isn't that a violation of something?
Oh, absolutely. Well, and what we've seen in a lot of cases, particularly with activists, is the use of, let's say, when somebody is arrested, or even if they're not arrested, they're detained and questioned, and it's really hanging the specter of what could happen over them in order to coerce and influence them into talking. And that, in a lot of the cases I talk about in my book, In Green is the New Red, that was a key part of that. It wasn't necessarily that police had any information on the people that they were approaching and talking to, or that the FBI had any leads, but they scared the daylights out of them to get something, to make people feel like they had to offer up something to get the police off of their back and to let them go.
Wow. So a lot of it is really just about gathering more information.
It is. And it's, you know, there's really been a sea change in how law enforcement approaches this. And some people would argue this has been going on pre-September 11th and accompanied by changes in technology. You know, we all know the romantic, you know, model of police burning shoe leather and knocking on doors and the kind of gumshoe approach. And now it's more of just vacuuming up all this information through the internet, through online, through telecommunications, through everything, and then trying to filter out any little particles of leads. So it's really an inversion of how law enforcement has gone about a lot of these counterterrorism cases for quite some time.
So, Will Potter, do you think if they were just to stop this these investigations, don't you think we would be at risk? I mean, the FBI alone admits that it is often just the single individual. Probably the biggest threat is a single individual that just gets, I don't know, whatever, unhinged. That's the biggest terrorist threat we've seen so far. But it's not too hard to imagine that something could develop that they weren't keeping an eye out.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't think the issue in any of these discussions about what has happened since September 11th, you know, I don't hear people arguing that law enforcement or the FBI shouldn't be following leads to make people safer and to prevent terrorist attacks. The problem arises when that word, terrorism, which is the most powerful word in our language right now, and has with it the potential to open up lots of access to money and police resources and restricted rights. Once you go down that path and you start investigating people as terrorists because of their political beliefs, that sets a really dangerous precedent. So accompanying these investigations and efforts that are being made to keep people safe, we also need to have checks and balances and oversight on government power. I mean, there's I think it was Benjamin Franklin, the classic quote, he who gives up a little bit of freedom for safety deserves neither. It has to be both.
Yeah, and there's also the argument that that maybe the money. I noticed that since 9/11, Congress has trouble spending money. It has trouble spending passing its appropriations bills. It's even got to the point now where they don't even bother with most of them. They just have been passing a continuing resolution and then cutting the budget through the continuing resolution rather than going through the regular appropriations process. And this is getting to be normal now. And my point is that the one thing that is exempted is Homeland Security and Defense. They always approve those budgets. Those are the one bunch of budgets that they always approve. And they get bigger and bigger and bigger. And you just wonder if maybe that's not the best way to spend the money, that's not the real investment that gets us to security. You know, at least I wonder.
Absolutely. And where does that money actually go? And that was an incredibly hard aspect of researching the book, is figuring out how much money is actually being spent on, for instance, so-called eco-terrorism investigations. You know, as this money flows from, most of the time, from Washington to the states, it goes to entities that are called fusion centers. It also goes to joint terrorism task forces. It goes to all these different operations around the country. And the problem is that with that money does not come accountability. There are very few restrictions and very few measures in place to ensure that the local law enforcement receiving counterterrorism money are properly trained in respecting people's right to privacy, their right to have their First Amendment rights protected in the course of counterterrorism investigations. So it really creates a lot of problems by having this cash cow that everybody wants a part of, and there's an incentive to show that you're a part of this terrorism investigation so you can get the money.
So you can get the money.
Well, in Texas, for instance, which is my home state, there was a report out a couple years ago of, you know, in order to get the money to one of the fusion centers, these law enforcement had to create lists of potential terrorism threats. Well, as a result, I think people can kind of predict what happened, is that these numbers were ridiculously inflated. They identified hundreds of groups as terrorism threats, including environmentalists and biker gangs and animal rights activists and all anti-war activists, Dominican nuns, all different types of people. And as that happens, it just lumps everybody together in order to show there's such a threat so they can get some of this money.
Wow. We're talking to Will Potter. He is author of Green is the New Red. We're kind of looking at the 10 years since 9/11 and what you'd have to say is a climate of fear. And the question I think I would propose to our listeners is, have we made ourselves more secure? Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. In Anchorage, it's a local call at 550-8422. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And it's sobering to think that there are children now that are 10 years old that did not ever see a world before 9/11. And I think in the immediate aftermath, every American knew that they had to give up some freedoms and some liberties for the sake of security. But now that 10 years has gone by, you know, a little trickle has kind of turned into a tide, it seems. And it's hard to know where are the tools to reverse this tide or to modify it or anything. It's just hard to know where the tools are or even how a person would participate in organizing around this issue. I mean, I take it you're involved in some of this, Will.
I am. And honestly, though, I struggle with the same questions, and I think everyone does, because, as you were saying, in those 10 years, so much of this has become normal, which then creates a new set of challenges. I mean, think about the Patriot Act, for instance, that when it was passed, there was a national uproar. I mean, there were dozens, if not over 100, local city council resolutions against the Patriot Act, and there was widespread community organizing against the sneak and peek search warrants, the national security letters, the checking out what books are checking out from the library, all these different things. Well, as different parts of that were up for renewal recently, there's very little national discussion. I mean, it was really in terms of, well, we got to go ahead and renew this to get this out the door because we have so many other things to take care of here in Washington.
I think in fact it was an element in the election. I think people were really
Absolutely.
Expecting an Obama administration to take a different position than it has on a lot of these things. I mean, Obama flatly promised to close down Guantanamo Bay, for instance.
And I mean, not only that, but the list really stretches quite long with the Obama administration, from extraordinary rendition, which is the practice of sending people to other countries to be tortured, and a practice that the administration has continued after Bush, to immunity for the telecom giants who illegally spied on Americans, to the creation of secretive political prison units on U.S. soil called communications management units. I mean, the list keeps going and going, and I think people are really disappointed with the Obama administration, but at the same time, like we were saying, not quite sure how to move forward.
You start your book with a guy that ended up in a CMU by the name of Daniel McGowan. I think he was part of the Earth Liberation Front?
That's right.
And so that was one of the targeted organizations, and he does end up in a prison, and you get to visit him, and it was kind of sobering, wasn't it?
It was very sobering. I mean, as background, McGowan was involved in some serious crimes. I mean, one of them, he was a lookout in an arson. In another one, he had an active role in an arson. Crimes that didn't harm any human beings, but they were serious property destruction. And he's now in a facility called a CMU, or Communications Management Unit. And when I visited him, the rest of the prison facility was shut down. We visited between bulletproof glass, not allowed to hug each other. When his wife visits him, he's not allowed to hug his wife. He's not allowed to hug his niece. No contact with family or friends. At the same time, our visit was live monitored by the counterterrorism unit. And for people who don't know and who have never been to a prison, none of this is normal. And in fact, it goes against a body of research of what is best for prisoners in terms of, you know, so-called rehabilitating them or ensuring that they have a healthy transition once they get out of prison. But not allowing him to have contact with his wife or his niece is really incredibly destructive.
And I guess they are also, like, limiting how many pages of correspondence you can have. He has a limit on how many books he can have. It goes on and on.
It goes on to number of minutes on the phone.
And it has to be all arranged in like a month and a half in advance.
And during times when most people are working. So, you know, instead of having visited, because the rest of the prison has visiting hours on the weekend, this has to be during the week. All of these things where I think if people don't know someone who's in prison or don't have never been that close to an issue like this, may not seem like the end of the world. Because after all, you know, people often assume, well, if someone's in prison, they must have done something wrong. But all of these things just create more and more hurdles that are punitive. And in some cases, these restrictions meet or even exceed some of the worst prisons in the country, such as the Supermax, ADX Florence, which, according to the government, is for the most violent prisoners, not somebody at all like Daniel McGowan.
And his organization, once again, the Earth Liberation Front. Let's go to Stephen, joins the program from Ketchikan. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Stephen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Talk of Alaska, it's a very interesting topic. I appreciate it. And my daughter was in New York 9/11. And she did had her portrait done in the Twin Towers. And she barely made it out of there when that airplane hit that tower. And I'm very thankful that she's alive. I was afraid. And, you know, I didn't expect something like that. I don't think America ever expected that. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of a story I read about Sir Winston Churchill when he was warning people for 8 years. He was warning, and I recall several times in America when America was warned about what was happening and the hate that was being propagated against America. And even today, you know, I used to have a beard, and I kind of got a dark skin. And I looked in the mirror, and I went and shaved my beard off and my mustache, because I kind of got dark skin, and I didn't want. I was afraid. And even today, when I walk down the street, I'm afraid when the police go by. You know, this is a time in America when there's a lot of fear, and I hope and pray that we get over it and we do protect our people. And I really thank, I'm going to get that book, and I really thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you for your call. It's great to hear from you again. You know, one thing that was coming to my mind, Will Potter, was if we're even on guard against the right threats, like what the real threats are. We devote a lot of time to, you know, talking about our current affairs and our problems in this country on this program. And I can think of things that, you know, are threatening that I don't know that there's much investment being made in at all. For instance, there are some significant environmental threats.
I mean, really significant environmental threats. We're in the Arctic, and the Arctic is melting. And I don't see too much investment in doing anything about that. China and other countries are outstripping us in all sorts of ways now. And I don't see too much investment in real industrial competitiveness at all. alternative energy. All sorts of countries now are investing in alternative energy, but not this one. You know, there's talk, but you don't really see the real investment happening. And it seems like it goes on and on, that the things that really are threatening us are not being addressed. And maybe some of the things we think are threats are really just phantoms. I mean, the Earth Liberation Front, for Pete's sake. You know, people that don't want laboratory animals used for testing cosmetics, those are threats? That's terrorism? I just don't know.
And, you know, to be clear, that some of these groups have engaged in some serious crimes. But when you talk to people on the street, I don't think I've ever met anyone who you ask them what their top priorities are, or what the government or the Obama administration or the Justice Department or the FBI should be focusing on. And they think it's people that are vandalizing SUVs or people that are investigating through with video cameras what goes on large factory farms. It's just not in touch with reality. And instead of doing things like protecting jobs or protecting the environment, we're actually going backwards. I mean, the Obama administration made a ruling just this week where they decided to block new standards that would have reduced smog pollution from cars and refineries and power plants and things like that. So at the same time that the environmental crisis is getting worse and worse, job situation is getting worse and worse, all of these things are going on, we're still focusing money and resources on these inflated threats.
Well, yeah, and it seems that security then can often be interpreted as the security of the established order, you know?
Absolutely. And I think that really is at the heart of so much of this, and not just with this issue, but with a lot of what's going on politically across the board, is that I think a lot of decisions are being made to protect vested political and corporate interests at the expense of what's best for everyday people. And we, you know, I don't think that's necessarily even a radical critique anymore, because I think people see it every day. You see the influence that corporations have over the law and over our lives compared to the voice that we have in the political process.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, and this is turning out to be an interesting discussion. Ralph Nader suggested that we spend the 10th of September reflecting in meetings in our towns and cities on the 10th to discuss ways to avoid overreactions to threats. And that's exactly, it seems like, what we're talking about, overreactions to threats. I think you put it really quite well. My guest is Will Potter. He's author of Green is the New Red, and we'll hear more from him as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Do you know a nonprofit executive or tribal leader who is at risk for job burnout? Nominate them for a Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical, which provides paid time away for personal renewal and growth. Go to Rasmussen.org for more information, but don't wait. Nominees must complete an application by October 1st. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
Ten years since 9/11, have we become bunkered in without even knowing it? Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And we're speaking with Will Potter, who wrote an insider's account of a social movement under siege called Green is the New Red, showing how the FBI and really other enforcement agencies as well are targeting animal rights and environmental activists as terrorists. And sometimes, in fairness, he says, sometimes they do illegal things. And that's a fact. But still, yeah, I needed to repeat the phone number here, Will, because I realized that somebody complained last week. And I thought I was repeating it enough, and they said, you know, I just kept waiting and waiting and waiting for it, and you never gave the phone number. I thought I did. So I'm going to give it again, 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, and email talk@alaskapublic.org. And I want to go to the final paragraph of your book, Green is the New Red, here and read it back. We have sacrificed too much in the name of fighting terrorism, and the enemy keeps growing. Since September 11th, the word has been stretched and pulled and hemmed and cuffed and torn and mended to fit a growing body of political whims. Ultimately, our response must ultimately be about the limits of the government's political tailoring. It is about reaching the point at which we have outgrown the rhetoric and we decide to stop wearing the past. Well, you've stretched a metaphor about stretching a metaphor. You know, I am really, your last words, wearing the past. I want to ask you about that and what you meant by that.
What I meant by that is how we go about our lives with this kind of cloaked over us. I mean, it's really become something that we carry with us throughout the day, I mean, without even paying much attention to it. I mean, especially living in Washington, D.C., I feel this all the time. For instance, when we had that earthquake recently, which was a rarity for D.C., but I remember standing out on the street and people were speculating if it was in fact an earthquake or if it was a terrorist attack. You know, and as we see every day, the threat levels are raised and lowered and raised and lowered. This has just become how we live our lives, and we kind of tune it out in some ways. But we wear this on a daily basis, and I think the danger is not reminding ourselves that it doesn't always have to be this way, that this isn't normal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's always tempting to think, oh, well, somebody must be pulling the strings. Somebody must be pushing our buttons. You know, we're being shock doctrined. What do you think?
Right, and well, referring to Naomi Klein's excellent book, The Shock Doctrine, I think
she just got arrested. By the way, I understand
at the tar sands protest in D.C. Right, she's incredible. She's an amazing work, and there are a lot of parallels here and with that kind of the philosophical framework that Naomi Klein is putting out there of how people in power use environmental crises and sometimes create crises in order to shock people into compliance and to push through their own agenda. That's exactly what happened, of course, after 9/11. Most people aren't aware of this, but on the same day that the Twin Towers fell, there were members of Congress, one, speculating that it was actually the work of environmentalists, and two, at the same time, saying that it was a threat no less heinous, that environmentalists were a threat no less heinous than what happened in Washington, D.C. and in New York City. I mean, I think that would be absolutely jaw-dropping to most people how quickly politicians tried to exploit this for their own benefit. And one of those people, by the way, was U.S. Representative Don Young.
Oh, yeah, I know. and you know, I think he really felt that, too. I think he's, you know, if he was here, we could ask him, but he has a feeling that there are many extreme environmentalists that that wish us ill, would like to bring down Western civilization. He probably believes that.
And that's often how this is framed. I mean, of your last comment of trying to bring down civilization, that's how some of these corporations and think tanks and politicians describe this. It's not so much about the specific tactics that some of these activists have used. It's about their beliefs. And that's really, to me, what is the biggest danger of this. They're not trying to stop, you know, a handful of people from destroying property or from releasing animals from a fur farm or any number of things. They are really going against an entire belief system and trying to shut down an entire movement with values that they disagree with. And if we allow policy in this country to be made based on that merit, that's a very dangerous path.
Something that, you know, being a bit older than you, and I've heard other people, older people that have had the same reflection of watching with alarm a growing brutalization of the populace, that you can see it, you know, a little bit in, you know, what kind of movies are selling. You know, it's got to have your car chases, but also there's a, you know, gratuitous and sometimes casual violence. And I'm just wondering, you know, I think it started before 9/11, but it seems that maybe it really kicked into turbo at that point, to the point where it's so much a part of our landscape now that we don't even see it. Probably hard for you to see at your age, what, 30-something?
You're talking about in terms of violence in the culture?
And a brutalization, just a certain, you know, tolerating things that would never have been tolerated before, tolerating incivilities, things that are done deliberately to offend.
Right.
It goes on and on, but brutalization, what I'm talking about is humiliating people and thinking it's okay and that sort of thing.
And it sounds like kind of a callousness and a general lack of respect.
Right. Well, downright cruelty. Cruelty sometimes. Pleasure and cruelty.
And I definitely have seen that one, you know, and shoot, I see that going from where I grew up outside Fort Worth to D.C., and just as years go by, you see those kind of changes in the way people react and changes in culture, what's allowed and, you know, permitted on television and films. But I think we also need to extend that discussion a little bit further and look at the violence and brutality on a national and international level. I mean, that when you have these people in power increasingly willing to go to war based on what we found out with Iraq, no reason at all, no evidence of actually having weapons of mass destruction, and being able to push that agenda to fit their own needs, whether or not it's actually true. I think that, to me, is just infinitely more disturbing when combined with everything else going on in the culture that you're describing as well.
Yeah. That was one, actually, that I was thinking of. And also then going back afterwards and saying, well, we believed that intelligence, you know, when the fact of the matter is you created the intelligence. How could you have believed it? You made it up yourself. And we saw this happen.
And I think so much of it is tied to arrogance. And I think arrogance as on a personal level and a political level, and we see that every day with politicians when left, right, Republican, Democrat, it doesn't matter. Just this arrogance that they're just beyond reproach. And we also see it at the national level, the arrogance of, you know, the United States as a entire entity and how we conduct policy with the rest of the world. There's really no other way to describe it. And now that with the economy and with everything, all the other changes going on in the world, when we as a country and as a economic system and as a people are knocked down a couple of notches, people are almost indignant by it. Like, how dare the rest of the world be succeeding more than we are, or have more jobs than we do, or anything like that?
How dare? Let's go to Daniel. Joins the program from Homer. Daniel, you're on the air with Will Potter.
Hey, top of the morning, gentlemen. Thank you so much for what you do. This has always been a pleasant show to engage in one way or another. I love it. I want to touch base. Well, you gentlemen already kind of beat me to the punch on my point, but I will say in brief that the tar sands situation led to protests, and I believe it was yesterday, perhaps the day before. There were about 700 people arrested outside the White House protesting this awful, awful idea of sending a pipeline from Canada to Galveston coastline. That got absolutely zero media coverage in the mainstream. But that's not—that's by design. My point, the reason I'm calling, gentlemen—
That's because we don't have any money in the news media anymore, so nobody works on Labor Day anymore.
Well, bless your heart. If I could change that, by golly, I darn sure would.
Yeah,
there's
go ahead, though.
We need good people like yourself out there investigating and holding the feet to the fire.
Right, yeah, I'm joking. Go ahead.
Well, listen, I want to say this. It's been 10 years. There's been a lot of investigating from all sorts of entities around the world. We know that there was never any yellow cake from Niger. That was a lie. We know that leaders of Saddam's regime met with leaders of al-Qaeda in Prague. That was a lie. We know that weapons of mass destruction were a lie. Aluminum tubes that were not intended for enriching uranium, easy for me to say, that was doctored. Now, we these things have come to the fore. If you've ever read George Tenet's book, he acknowledges in his book that the George Bush administration, in collusion with other world powers like the British, were deceiving this and other countries into a situation that is murdering innocent people from this and other countries. Somebody once said that Mexico attacked the United States and we retaliated against Canada. And that's the issue for me, is that we went anyway. Protests fell on deaf ears. Experts that came out and said, no, we haven't found any WMDs, and we need more time. The Bush administration said, get out, we're bombing tomorrow. How do the people, the population, how do we, the people, change that status quo that our current president promised he was going to do? But as I told everybody from the first day, he is the status quo. How do we stand up? What do we need, another Tahrir Square here in America? How do we get our elected officials to do the right thing? That's my question.
Daniel, I don't think any of us have an answer for it, but thanks for the call.
Yes, sir. Thank you for what you do, gentlemen.
Thank you, Daniel. Will Potter, you want to chime in on that?
Well, you're right. Unfortunately, I don't. I have a good answer for that, and I don't know if any of us do right now, but I think we know kind of the direction we should be going. And from, I appreciate the caller's comments also about the tar sands action. And if people aren't familiar with that, over the last several weeks in Washington, D.C., over 1,200 people were arrested using nonviolent civil disobedience in protest of this pipeline. Now, to me, it is really disappointing, as the caller said, that it didn't get the media attention it deserves, because this is an environmental issue, this is a jobs issue, this is something that affects all of us. But at the same time, it is inspiring to see things like that happening. 1,200 people went to jail in protest in a nonviolent civil disobedience over this pipeline's creation. To me, that is a good example of not putting our hope and change, to use Obama's slogans, in people in power, but to put it in each other, and to really turn to each other and turn to our communities and to people around us, and to ask each other this question, what do we need to be doing? What can we do? For some people, that might be civil disobedience. Other people, it might be, holding a protest or just organizing an event at their church or their community space. It can take a lot of different forms, but I think as long as we're asking each other that question, that's got to be the first step.
What do you think about underground? Can you be underground? I'm thinking, for instance, of the preemptive strike that was made on people before the Republican convention. You probably know about that.
Right, and there's actually a great film about that out now called Better This World that I'd recommend people check out. And what was really important about that case is how, you know, there are a few young people that were allegedly going to take part in clashes with police and some property destruction at these mass protests, which, you know, if that were to happen, that's obviously a crime and should be prosecuted and investigated. But it turns out that law enforcement had been using an informant to coerce people into action, to actually get these things to happen.
So oh, my God, we're back in COINTELPRO. We're provocateurs. Oh, I can't believe this is happening again. I'm going to go to Fred.
Absolutely.
I'm going to go to Fred now in North Pole. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Fred. You're on the air with Will Potter.
Oh, good morning. I wanted to quickly echo Stephen's thought that I am more afraid of my government than I am of anybody from the Middle East. I think it's truly fearsome. The other point I wanted to make was recall that there's no such thing as the government. The government cannot speak, feel, think, or go to jail. It is your fellow citizens, our fellow citizens, who are doing this to us, not some nebulous idea. And, you know, to echo the previous caller's thought, the news media could do a better job. Instead of saying the government is doing this, name a person who's doing it. If it comes from the president, name the president. If it comes from some high official in a bureaucracy, name the person. Don't say Homeland Security did this. It's the director of Homeland Security, John or Jane Doe, who did this. And the third thing is this... this paranoia that is in the country goes way, way back. I'm looking right now at a pamphlet published by the First Army Headquarters in 1955 called How to Spot a Communist. And if you substitute terrorist, you could change a few of the words, you would get exactly what we hear today.
I remember it, Fred. I was 12 years old at the time. Thanks for that call from North Pole as Talk of Alaska continues.
Thank you.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Renewable Energy Alaska Project, celebrating 7 years of educating Alaskans on clean, local, sustainable, renewable energy. Find out more online at realaska.org. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Are bunny huggers the new red? Is green the new red? That's the subject today on Talk of Alaska. Lowell emailed from Anchorage saying, America doesn't have a failing economy. It has a failing, gridlocked, two-party political system that has failed our economy. I don't know if Americans elect is the answer, but I will be giving it a hard look. It's time for a new party to support moderate Americans and marginalize the fringe elements in both parties that try to monopolize political discourse. That from Lowell in Anchorage, who tosses in the website of www.americanselect.org. And we'll go to Skagway. Bob joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bob, with Will Potter.
Yeah, this is Bob here. I just had a couple of comments. I was fishing over in Cordova, commercial fishing over in Cordova when at 9/11, and one of my crew members there, first thing he told me, which really stunned me, and he was really quite a prophet, he said, now they're going to use this as an excuse to curtail our civil liberties. He saw that right off the bat, and real prophetic. I'm 63 years old. I've never been so afraid of my government in my entire life as I was after 9/11 with the clampdowns, the doing away with habeas corpus, the secret prisons, secret prisoners, U.S. Citizens in prisons, and never been so ashamed of my government since the 1950s during the civil rights era. And I do feel a little more secure when I'm flying now because of all the main security there, but I feel much more fearful about my own government and ashamed that the American people allowed the government to disregard the Constitution in so many various ways as a result of 9/11. Anyhow, that's about all I have to say, and I'll get off the line unless you have a question for me.
No, Bob, I want to thank you for sounding off from Skagway, though.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, bye.
All right, Russ joins the program from Haines. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Russ.
Yeah, hi. Great show, great topic.
It bears a lot of talking about to get anywhere is my conclusion on this one.
Yeah, it seems to me a big part of the whole terrorism issue is really about the money, you know, just from they used it to tie in, try to tie Saddam Hussein in to justify the invading Iraq, and then how finding out within, I think it was the first year, there was some report like $9 billion disappeared. You know, they don't know where it went, the, you know, funds that went over there.
Yeah, it was a whole cargo pallet of money.
Right, and yeah. There was a report, was it just last week, a federal report about they looked into the waste of the wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, and they came up with some $6 billion, or I forget the number, but it was in the billions, you know, that was unaccounted for again.
Well, you know, that's some of that is jobs, though.
Well, yeah, but it also causes...
No, some of that is, I'll say this, some of it is 8As.
Eight what?
8As, the native corporations and the SBA exemption they get.
Oh, okay. I mean,
a lot of that goes to a lot of security businesses.
Right. Yeah. Well, also all that money though causes funding for social programs, even infrastructure and stuff, you know, to get cut here in the country. That could have been creating more jobs here, which actually would make things more secure here. You know, instead we've got this huge recession. I mean, caused by banking stuff as well, but just the fact that the country's basically going bankrupt, you know, people are, you know, there's less jobs and people are less secure here, which puts people on edge more and makes us less secure in that way, I think. You know, it just has other ramifications, but coming back to the, you know, just using the war to funnel money in, you know, just like he was saying about creating lists of terrorist organizations so people can get money, you know, cities or whatever can get money to spend.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to put that in. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Again. Great show.
Yeah, we get thinking about the F-22s we have sitting up at our base that they don't fly anymore.
Right, yeah.
It's never
a lot of money for those.
To add something to, I appreciate you saying that. I think it's a really important point because in addition to that, there's actually an audit by the Inspector General of the Justice Department in 2003, and the Inspector General told the FBI that they should stop targeting social protesters, is what they described it as, because it's there were better ways to spend law enforcement resources that would not only be more efficient, but would make people safer, which it seems like both of the things that you mentioned in your comment. And the FBI refused, and part of the reason they refuse is that this turf war. You know, everybody wants to have a stake in the war on terrorism to show that they're relevant. And, you know, nobody wants to relinquish that little bit of power or money that they have. And so you have exactly what you were describing, you know, these policies in place where we could be better off spending this money elsewhere.
All right.
And the budget, you know, like you said, too, the defense budget never gets cut. So you're safe, you know, if you can tap into that, money, it's just going to keep coming because they got everybody scared.
All right, thanks.
And because the you know, there's no end to the war on terrorism. It's not a war that's ever going to be won. I know that the phrase has kind of fallen out of fashion a little bit with the Obama administration, but the mentality of it is still there.
All right, thanks, Russ, for your call from Haines.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Joanne Jones, the program from Homer again. Joanne, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. What I'd like to say, and I'm not in any way minimizing the grief of the people who lost relatives and friends, but this country loses an awful lot of people every year to car accidents. But if our government was imposing some of the draconian measures on our driving that they do in the name of national security, to keep down traffic fatalities, we'd never tolerate it. And if we lose our liberties over acts of terrorism, then the terrorists have won.
Wow. Joanne, thank you. Very, very cogently put.
Great point.
Okay, I'm going to try to get another caller in, okay? Thanks, Joanne. Let's go to Todd, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alice in Palmer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Alice. Alice, you with us?
Really encouraged to hear so many folks that are like-minded. I feel that in Palmer, we're going to be under attack shortly because we have the proposed Wishbone Hill coal mine.
Are you going to the meeting tonight?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's important that people realize that corporations are actually getting more voice than the average citizen. And the propaganda that keeps getting spewed out by corporations, it's just unconscionable about what they're trying to do to the environment and indicating that, it's not a big issue. But these are times where the average person needs to be strong and stand up and go to their assembly and voice their concerns about being kind of railroaded through and not being listened to. Tonight's assembly is just to give the borough's blessing to instruct the Department of Natural Resources to rubber stamp a permit.
Right.
And
all right.
We need to stand up for the citizens' rights in our environment.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Will Potter. I want to thank you so much for being with us. The book is Green is the New Red. And I want to thank Kristen Spock and Josh Edge for being with us today. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AK Business Month or Facebook, and by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender. A little communication can save a life. Take time to connect with the ones you love and show them you care. This is National Suicide Prevention Week. Know the signs and take them seriously. For help and information, visit carelinealaska.com or call the 24-hour hotline 1-877-266-HELP. This message is sponsored by the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.